Dene and Zeme suggested that three of these, CFS, fibromyalgia, multiple chemical sensitivity, may simply reflect different aspects of a common underlying mechanism. And there are other people who made similar statements. Chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, one has a literature that suggests that some people do recover completely from those, roughly 10%. With the multiple chemical sensitivity group, such recoveries rarely, if ever, occur. So in general, these are huge problems because almost all people who become ill stay ill through their life, although they may see improvements over time. And so this talk will focus on MCS, on multiple chemical sensitivity. However, the comparison with these other multi-system illnesses is useful, and at times during my talk I'll refer to some of the others because often the mechanisms that one sees in the others also show up with MCS. So I will refer to all three of them. Now, one of the great puzzles about MCS is how can diverse chemicals that are implicated in initiating cases of MCS, how can they produce these exquisite sensitivity responses? And basically the same set of chemicals that seem to be involved in the initiation also produce sensitivity responses in those who are already sensitive. So we have that great puzzle about how you get initiation and how that then leads to this high-level sensitivity. Some of the MCS skeptics, including Ronald Gotz, have argued that there cannot be a common response to such a broad group of chemicals. And I will show here that they're wrong about that. So among the chemicals that are implicated in initiating cases of MCS, one has a very broad group of organic solvents and related compounds. And then there are three classes of pesticides, the organophosphorus and carbamate pesticides, the organic chlorine pesticides, and the pyrethroid pesticides. And then occasionally these other three also have roles in initiating cases. Okay? So the question is, how can these broad groups of chemicals produce a common response in the body? And what I've proposed is basically that they act along known pathways and that they all end up leading to increases in NMDA activity. So we have here the organic solvents. We think that they work primarily but not solely via a receptor called the vanilloid or TRPV1 receptor. And that can increase NMDA activity. There are the organophosphorus and carbamate pesticides, which act as cholinesterase inhibitors, and they in turn produce increases in NMDA activity. The organochlorines, including lindane and chlordane and several others, act as GABA-A antagonists, and that in turn increases NMDA activity. And the pyrethroids act to open sodium channels, and that in turn leads to NMDA increases. So we have all of these things acting along different pathways but producing a common response. And so immediately we have an interesting model here of how these various agents can act to produce a common response in the body. Okay, now let me just say one other thing about this, and it's actually quite important, and that is they're members of each of these classes of chemicals that have been tested in animal models. And it's been shown that if you use an NMDA antagonist, that is, you use a drug that lowers the NMDA activity, you can greatly lower the toxicity of these compounds in the body. So we not only know that you get an increase in NMDA activity, but that that increase is very important for the toxic responses in the body. Okay, so and there's a similar.
I guess I've already gone through that, so I'll just skip it.
There are similar properties for the other three compounds that I talked about before: hydrogen sulfide, carbon monoxide, and mercury. Mercury acts via its product methylmercury, and each of these can produce increased NMDA activity, and you can use NMDA antagonists and lower the toxic responses to all three of these. Okay, so we have a really quite a stunning convergence of mechanism of all of these classes of chemicals that are implicated in MCS. Okay, now, and so this very strongly suggests that this increase in NMDA activity is involved. Sorry. There are six other types of evidence which implicate increased NMDA activity in MCS. And is that better? And I'm not going to go through these in detail because we have limited time, but basically what I want to say here is that some of these implicate increased NMDA activity in the initiation of cases of MCS, including, say, number two, where a genetic change that produces increased NMDA activity is associated with increased prevalence of MCS, but also that chemicals that act to produce sensitivity responses in people who are already sensitive, such as in number three, for example, let's see, I'm having trouble with this pointer, that you can lower the responses in people who are already chemically sensitive by using an NMDA antagonist. And what does that do? That suggests that the increased NMDA activity has a crucial role in responding to chemicals in people who are already chemically sensitive. Okay, so that's important. So we have six additional types of evidence for a role of increased NMDA activity. And I think this is really compelling evidence for a common toxicological response to all of these chemicals that are implicated here. Now, there's one other very important type of evidence which shows that the chemical exposure here is causal. That is, it is causal. It is involved in initiating cases of MCS. And that's this genetic evidence. And there are three important studies that have been done on the genetics here. One was done by Haley and co-workers with the Gulf War syndrome people. And another one was done by McKee and Eisen on Canadian MCS patients. And the third was done by Schnackenberg and co-workers on German MCS patients. And what they have shown is that a whole series of genes which have crucial roles in the metabolism of these same compounds, particularly the organic solvents and the organophosphorus pesticides, have roles in determining whether people are especially susceptible to coming down with MCS. And so we have five of these genes where there's really quite strong evidence for that, and then a sixth, the bottom one, where there's weaker evidence. All of these have roles then in the metabolism of these same compounds. And the only interpretation for this set of data is that these chemicals are acting as toxicants and in their role as initiating cases of MCS, and therefore the genes that influence the rate of metabolism of those chemicals will influence people's susceptibility to them and to coming down with MCS. Okay, and, so this is, I think, very important evidence, and it really produces a compelling argument that these chemicals are acting as toxicants in initiating cases of MCS. And we also have evidence, as I mentioned a little while ago, that the chemicals are also acting as toxicants when they produce sensitivity responses in those who are already sensitive. Now, one thing that you may have noted already is that the receptors for those chemicals that I discussed are not the olfactory receptors. They are not the receptors that are involved in detecting odors. And yet people have over and over again talked about sensitivity to odors. And I think the important point that needs to be emphasized here is that MCS people are sensitive to chemicals. Many of those chemicals have odors, but that does not mean that the primary sensitivity is to odor. And now that's not to say that people with MCS do not have changes in their olfactory mechanism. Some of them, I think, do, but that's not the primary mechanism of MCS. Okay, so what happens then when you stimulate the NMDA receptors is that there are channels that are part of the receptor mechanism that allow calcium to flow into the cell. Calcium then stimulates these two enzymes, NNOS and ENOS, which are both nitric oxide synthases. These are both enzymes that produce nitric oxide, and both of them are calcium dependent. That is, they have to have calcium there in order to be active. And so when the calcium flows into the cell, you get an increase in nitric oxide as a consequence of that. And some of that reacts with another compound called superoxide to form a compound called peroxynitrite, which is a potent oxidant. And so all of these things are known to occur in response to the increased NMDA activity. And as I think you'll see, it appears that all of these responses are important in the MCS mechanism. So we have NMDA activity, we have calcium, we have these forms of nitric oxide synthases, we have a nitric oxide, and we have peroxynitrite. All those things are important, and I'll show you, I think, how they all come in to this mechanism that produces this exquisite chemical sensitivity. So the kind of central chemistry here, if you will, this is the only chemistry I'm going to talk about, is this reaction of nitric oxide, which is this structure, NO, and this is a free radical, and superoxide, which is another free radical, and those two react extremely rapidly with each other to form this compound peroxynitrite. Peroxynitrite is not a free radical, but it's a potent oxidant, and it can break down to form other free radicals. And so it can produce a lot of damage in the body. And we'll talk about some of that, but probably not in much detail given the amount of time that we have here. Okay, so now, so the each of these illnesses, here's MCS, multiple chemical sensitivity, and here are the compounds that we talked about that can initiate cases of MCS. There are also a number of stressors that can initiate cases of chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, and also post-traumatic stress disorder, which I've argued is actually a member of this group. And so these are all or almost all short-term stressors, and yet they can initiate this these chronic illnesses. And let me just say there are a total of 17 different short-term stressors that are shown in this table here. And there may be others in addition, but these are the ones that are best documented in the literature as stressors that can initiate these illnesses. And they, and so one of the great puzzles is, what, you know, how can all these things produce a similar response in the body and produce chronic illness? And what I've argued is that all of these can act to increase nitric oxide levels in the body. Some of them, as you've already seen, do that through the NMDA receptors, but some of them do that through other mechanisms, like the infectious agents, viral and bacterial infection, protozoan infection, toxoplasmosis, ionizing radiation exposure. All those act not via NMDA receptors, but via the induction of the inducible nitric oxide synthase that's often abbreviated iNOS. And so we have different mechanisms, but they all produce a nitric oxide response. That seems to be the common response for all of them, okay? Now, as I said before, all of the ones that are involved in multiple chemical sensitivity work via NMDA, and I think there's an important reason why that's true, and I'll show you that in a little while. But in general, the ability to initiate these chronic illnesses is not dependent on the NMDA receptors. It seems to be dependent on nitric oxide, and probably more importantly, dependent on peroxynitrite, its oxidant product. So what I proposed is that the way in which nitric oxide works is through this peroxynitrite compound over here, and that it works to initiate a complex vicious cycle here, which is then the cause of illness. Can you hear me all right with all the noise? Can I be heard? So basically, each of these arrows here represents one or more mechanisms by which one of these things increases a second, okay? And I'd like to kind of go through some of these with you, just to give you some idea as to how they fit together. But I think the point that you can see already from this figure, from this diagram here, is that there are a number of cycles in here that are interacting. You know, you've got this one, and you've got that one, and you've got this one, and you've got this one, and then you've got some others going up around here. So basically what we have here is a set of interacting vicious cycles. And the idea is that the whole cycle, which I call the no-ono cycle based on the structure of nitric oxide and the structure of peroxynitrite, but obviously involves a whole bunch of other things as well, that once this cycle gets going, it is the cause of illness, and that the initial cause is to get this thing started, okay? So you have these initial short-term stressors that get the cycle going, and then you have the cycle itself, which is the cause of the chronic illness, and you can kind of see, you know, why it would be chronic, because these things are going to keep triggering responses, and so you'll have these things. Okay, so what are they? We have nitric oxide here. We have superoxide. They react with each other to form peroxynitrite. Peroxynitrite, being a potent oxidant, produces oxidative stress, which is an imbalance between oxidants and antioxidants. These two can increase intracellular calcium levels, which in turn can activate these two nitric oxide synthases and make more nitric oxide. These oxidative stress and, to a lesser extent, the calcium can increase the activity of this. This is NF-kappa-B. This is a transcription factor. This is a protein which turns on certain genes in the nucleus of the cell. And so when it is activated, NF-kappa-B, it turns on these inflammatory cytokine genes, and it also activates this inducible nitric oxide synthase gene, okay? And the cytokines in turn activate iNOS, okay? So you get an iNOS induction, both direct from NF-kappa-B and indirect through the cytokines. And what does that do? Well, it produces more nitric oxide, and so it can kind of come around and act here. There are a number of mechanisms that are also expected and in fact, have been shown to increase superoxide levels involving peroxynitrite, involving nitric oxide, and I'm not going to talk about what those are, but all of these are discussed in great detail in my book, explaining, quote, unexplained illnesses. There's an increase in, here's our NMDA activity, and I'll show you how NMDA activity can be increased in a little while. And there's another receptor here called the vanillide receptor, which we also think has a role. And in fact, there are probably some other members of this group of receptors, which I'll refer to very briefly, that also have a role here. So this is what we call the no-no cycle. And actually, even though this is rather complex, it turns out it's still more complex than this. So I apologize for that, but that's the way science is sometimes. So there are two aspects of this cycle which are not obvious from the discussion that I just gave you. One is that there are a number of mechanisms by which mitochondria and consequently energy metabolism is dysfunctional as a consequence of the attack of peroxynitrite on a number of the components of the mitochondria as a function of the role of superoxide also in the mitochondria and also nitric oxide. All three of these can inhibit or inactivate important components in the mitochondria that will then lead to mitochondrial dysfunction and energy metabolism dysfunction and a depletion of ATP, which of course is the energy currency in the cell. So these mechanisms turn out to be important not only because they have roles in producing some of the symptoms and signs, but also because they have actual roles in the cycle itself. And I'll talk to you a little bit about a couple of the roles in the cycle where we think that they have important roles. Okay. There's another set of mechanisms here. And I apologize for giving you all this biochemistry that, you kind of have, and I have to say I've learned a lot of biochemistry myself in researching this. The nitric oxide synthases have a cofactor that is essential for their production of nitric oxide called tetrahydrobiopterin, and it's usually abbreviated BH4. Okay, so we have this BH4. And when you have a deficiency in tetrahydrobiopterin, then some of the nitric oxide synthases become what's been called uncoupled. That is, they no longer produce nitric oxide, and they start producing in place of that superoxide. So they produce superoxide in place of the nitric oxide. So you have, and so what you can have when you have some cells or tissues that have particularly high levels of nitric oxide synthase and where they become partially uncoupled, you can have adjacent enzymes right next to each other, one of them producing nitric oxide, one of them producing superoxide, and these will then react very quickly to form more peroxynitrite. And what will that do? Well, what peroxynitrite does is it oxidizes tetrahydrobiopterin. And so it can keep this partial uncoupling going. Okay, and what I think is true, and I've come to this fairly recently, is that this mechanism here is likely to be the core of the no-no cycle. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about it is that it is that if you improve this part of it, that is, if you increase the availability of tetrahydrobiopterin, BH4, what you will do is you will increase nitric oxide levels, but you also get a clinical improvement. Okay, so nitric oxide is not always the bad guy in this thing. In this context, increasing nitric oxide via this mechanism, via lowering uncoupling, should be helpful rather than hurtful. Okay. Okay, so this is the new no-no cycle, which includes all those things that I just talked about. And I don't know, it actually, sometimes I think I'm not very quick on these things. It took me about 2 years to figure out how to diagram this. So here we have... Okay. Here we have peroxynitrite, that's abbreviated PRN. And, excuse me, here we have BH4, and so this is depleted. And so here we have this reciprocal relationship between peroxynitrite and tetrahydrobiopterin. Okay. So here we have this reciprocal relationship between these two, which, as I said before, I think this may be actually the core of the cycle. And then we have all these other things. Then we have ATP depletion, energy metabolism depletion over here. And these all have important roles then in the cycle. And I've diagrammed these, and I'm not going to go into them in detail here, but... and here's some of the other things we've talked about before. Nitric oxide, superoxide, oxidative stress, NF-kappa-B, iNOS, the other nitric oxide synthases here, intracellular calcium, and NMDA receptors. And there's these receptors here. This is the vanillide receptor that I mentioned before is a member of this receptor family. And there, I think actually now there are probably some other members of this family that have a role here, and I'll talk about perhaps one or two of those later on. Okay, can you hear me better now? Okay, so we have here five principles which underlie this no-ono cycle mechanism. And these are important for at least three reasons that I'll share with you shortly. But let's look at these principles. The first one we've already talked about, that short-term stressors act to initiate these illnesses by increasing either nitric oxide or other cycle elements, and so they have to start out. They have to be able to interact with the cycle then. These increases then, particularly in peroxynitrite, initiate this no-no cycle, which is then the cause of these chronic illnesses. And one of the consequences and predictions of this is that each of the elements of the cycle will be elevated in the chronic phase of illness. And, of course, that's testable, and we have substantial data on that, particularly with the CFS fibromyalgia group, but also some with the MCS group. the symptoms and signs of illnesses must be caused by elevated elements of the no-no cycle, okay? So, in other words, all the symptoms and signs should be caused by some of these things, you know, nitric oxide, superoxide, peroxynitrite, NF-kappa-B, oxidative stress, etc. Okay, so those have to be involved in the production of the symptoms and signs in order for this to be a known all-cycle disease. The fourth principle turns out to be a very important one, and that is that the basic biochemistry of this cycle is local. Okay, what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is that it will be present in certain tissues in particular individuals and in other tissues in other individuals. That is, it's basically a local mechanism. And the reason that it's local is because the three compounds involved, nitric oxide, superoxide, and peroxynitrite, have short half-lives in biological tissues. So they don't go very far from where they're initially made to where they're destroyed, typically. And the mechanisms of the cycle, all those arrows that we talked about before, act at the level of individual cells. So we are talking about a mechanism which will be present in certain tissues in one individual and a different set of tissues in another individual. And because of that, you can, first of all, have multiple diseases caused by the same mechanism, depending on where the tissue impact is. And secondly, you see a tremendous amount of variation in symptoms and signs from one individual to another, even those that have been diagnosed as having a particular disease. So, for instance, with the chronic fatigue syndrome group, you see a lot of variations. With the multiple chemical sensitivity group, you see a lot of variations. This has been a great puzzle because, people said, well, how can they be real diseases if they're so variable? And the answer, I think, is actually very simple. The answer is that the tissue impact in the different individuals is different. And that will then provide a lot of variation in symptoms and signs. Okay. Now, the fifth principle is that therapy should focus on down-regulating the known cycle. That is, we should focus on lowering the cause rather than on relieving the symptoms. Okay. And so that's obviously the most important principle from the standpoint both of sufferers and also from the standpoint of physicians that are trying to effectively treat them. So basically what I've argued is that these known cycle diseases represent what I argue is the 10th paradigm of human disease. That is, there are nine well-accepted paradigms that I've listed here of human diseases, and I'm arguing this is the 10th. And in fact, it may be one of the more important ones of those 10 as well. And so this is, I think, quite exciting. And there are a number of other diseases in addition to the ones that I've discussed where one can make a case that they may be known as cycle diseases. And I think I will talk about some of those later on if we have time. Okay, I'm going to go through this just very quickly. But in chapter 3 of my book, I discuss how a variety of different symptoms and signs of these this group of illnesses, things that are shared among all four of them, how they may be generated by mechanisms initiated by specific elements of the known cycle. And what I want to say here, basically, and just point out to you is that these mechanisms are pretty well documented in the literature. The question is, are these the mechanisms that are occurring in these illnesses? And there, I think, in most cases, we don't have good evidence for that. But what's true is that there's a wide variety of different changes that should be produced by these elements of the cycle. Fatigue presumably is caused by energy metabolism dysfunction. there are changes in immune function that can be produced by inflammatory cytokines, oxidative stress, superoxide, including low natural killer cell function, which has often been reported with this group of illnesses, problems with learning and memory dysfunction, problems with circulatory dysfunction, particularly orthostatic intolerance, pain. They're basically all the elements of the cycle can be involved in generating pain in hyperalgesia situations. Depression can be produced by the inflammatory cytokines and by increased nitric oxide. So so one can have psychiatric symptoms, one can have pain, one can have other types of brain dysfunction, immune dysfunction, circulatory dysfunction, and so forth. And the changes in sleep, anxiety, this is one I found particularly interesting because there are animal models where one could take an NMDA agonist, and a specific NMDA agonist, and inject it into the amygdala in the brain of an animal. And you can get anxiety and even panic attack responses simply from doing that. So presumably a local increase in the cycle in the amygdala should be able then to produce anxiety responses. Abnormal SPECT scans, PET scans, so forth. So there are quite a number of things that should be able to be produced by these cycle elements. And again, these are well-known mechanisms, but whether they apply to this group of illnesses is still unclear, okay? So I'm not saying that we've proven that these are the mechanisms with these illnesses. Okay. So we have the four illnesses, and presumably the differences among them have to do with which specific tissues are impacted by the NO-NO cycle in one illness versus another. And so the question is, what's going on with MCS, and how can people become so extraordinarily sensitive to chemicals as a function of previous chemical exposure? Okay, and that's really perhaps most important set of questions that one can ask about MCS. Okay, and I think one of the things about MCS is that one has sensitivities that come both from the central nervous system and also other sensitivities that come from peripheral regions of the body, and I'll talk about both of those rather briefly. Okay, but the central part is probably the most characteristic thing about MCS, and perhaps the most important for us to understand. And so basically what I'm going to discuss here is the fact that there was a previous model of MCS that was developed by Dr. Iris Bell, who's at the University of Arizona in the U.S., and she argued that there was a neural sensitization mechanism that was involved, presumably in the hippocampus and other related regions of the brain. This is the region of the brain that's involved in learning and memory. And so her argument was that chemicals somehow, and I'll show you how in a little bit, in fact I've already sort of showed you how, could produce a great neural sensitization where the synapses between one neuron and a second were much more active than they would be normally as a consequence of chemical exposure. Okay, and so basically the idea here is that this process of neural sensitization, which is known to be involved to be activated on a very selective basis in normal learning and memory, may be activated massively in MCS as a consequence of chemical exposure. That was her basic model. Now, the main thing, the thing that I want to emphasize here is the following. The main mechanism for neural sensitization is something called long-term potentiation, abbreviated LTP. Long-term potentiation is known to involve increased NMDA receptor activity. Okay, so here are NMDA receptors. And I think the reason why all these chemicals have to act through the NMDA receptors is basically this one. This is essential for getting long-term potentiation. And this process not only involves increased NMDA activity, but it involves increased intracellular calcium, increased nitric oxide, and also increased superoxide. A number of the elements of the NONO cycle can be seen to have important roles in neural sensitization. What we're arguing is that the chemical exposure that we talked about before that can increase all of these things can very plausibly have a major impact on neural sensitization through a variety of different mechanisms. Okay, so I've got a greatly oversimplified diagram of how some of this plays out in MCS that I've called the neural sensitization cycle. And basically, here's a presynaptic cell, and here's a postsynaptic cell. And what happens in neural sensitization is that basically this arrow becomes more active and you get more NMDA stimulation in the postsynaptic cell. Okay. Now, when the postsynaptic cell is stimulated, you can get an increase in nitric oxide, as we've already said, because when you stimulate NMDA receptors, you get an increase in nitric oxide. One of the things that nitric oxide does in this mechanism is that it acts as what's known as a retrograde messenger. That is, it can go back to the presynaptic cell and make it more active in releasing the neurotransmitter. And the important neurotransmitter here is glutamate, which is the normal NMDA agonist here. And you also can then get peroxynitrite as a function of the increased nitric oxide, and you can get energy depletion. Okay, so what does energy depletion do? Well, energy depletion acts in two ways to increase NMDA activity. One is that it actually makes these receptors more sensitive to stimulation. And the other thing is that it actually means that the glutamate that is released from the presynaptic cell is actually more active in the stimulation. So there's a double effect here. Immediately you can kind of see how chemical exposure coming in and stimulating these could lead through a number of different mechanisms to giving you an increase in neural sensitization and consequently an increase in chemical sensitivity. Now, I've talked about seven different mechanisms, and again, these are all well-known mechanisms, but their role in MCS is primarily hypothetical at this point. But still in all, these are all mechanisms that are predicted to be stimulated as a consequence of that, and each of them will lead to an increase in chemical sensitivity at a different level. And so the idea is that each of these, here's the retrograde messenger function, here's a function of just NONO cycle elevation. But the two roles of energy metabolism that we discussed a little while ago are here. But also nitric oxide can inhibit the metabolism of these chemicals via this mechanism. Peroxynitrite can lead to a breakdown in the blood-brain barrier, which would lead then to increased chemical access to the brain. That's another mechanism. And let me just say that Dr. Bodo Kuklinski in Germany has published some studies showing that this does occur in MCS patients this particular, the breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, does occur in MCS patients. And Abudonia has shown this in animal models as well. And then there's an effect on the vanilloid receptors that would be specific probably for organic solvents. So we've argued that the organic solvents work primarily through this vanilloid receptor. So if you increase this activity, you'll get increased stimulation by organic solvents. So you can kind of see how relatively small changes in each of these could lead to a huge change in chemical sensitivity because they're going to multiply on each other, okay? So, you know, if you have a threefold increase here and a fivefold increase here and so forth, and you multiply each of these together, you can see how you can get a thousandfold or even greater increase in sensitivity based on all of these different mechanisms. And so basically, I think that's what's going on with MCS and why MCS peoples can be so exquisitely sensitive to chemicals that at levels that normal people have no problems with at all, that one can see. So this is, I think, the basic explanation for the phenomenon that one sees here. Okay, now, let me just say, I'm going to skip through most of this, but basically, I think that some of the peripheral sensitivity mechanisms are the same as the ones we talked about before for the central nervous system, but there may also be other ones that come in here. And specifically, Bill Maggs and Gunnar Heuser have published evidence that there's a phenomenon called neurogenic inflammation in the peripheral sensitivities now, and also mast cell activation have roles, and both of these can be these are both compatible with the neuronal cycle mechanisms, and so these may be part of the neuronal cycle in these in the peripheral tissue. So in MCS, you often see sensitivity in the nasal passages, in the upper respiratory tract, in the bronchi of the lungs. You basically have asthma-type symptoms. You have sensitivity in regions of the skin. You have sensitivity in the GI tract. And there's several other tissues that can become sensitive as well. Which tissues are impacted varies from one MCS patient to another. So you don't see all the same patterns. And in fact, we knew a person in Pullman, Washington, who only had, as far as I could figure out, sensitivity in her upper respiratory tract. She had no sensitivity in the brain. She'd had no asthma-type symptoms. She had no skin sensitivity symptoms. She just had sensitivity in the upper respiratory tract. So you can have, and that, by at least some definitions, doesn't qualify as being MCS, but I think basically the mechanism that she was seeing in her upper respiratory tract was essentially the same as what MCS people have. It's just she didn't have other tissues impacted. So you can kind of see how the local nature of this can come into it and can give you a variety of different symptoms from one individual to another. Okay, and that's obviously important in terms of understanding what's going on here. Okay, now, I think what I'm going to do here is just to spend some time on this, and then I'm going to skip over to therapy because we have limited amount of time here, and I want to leave some time for questions. One of the obvious great needs in MCS, and in fact in this whole group of illnesses, is the need for specific biomarker tests, for tests in which you can take a patient who at least has been tentatively diagnosed as having MCS in this case, and ask, is there an objective test that can be done that confirms that diagnosis? And one of the things that I found surprising, actually, is that there are a number of such tests that in my judgment, have been described in the literature that look to me like they should be very good specific biomarker tests. And yet, one of the things that's been an important thing in this area is that none of these have been sort of widely recognized as specific biomarker tests. So, I want to speak basically about three of them, because I think three of them are particularly attractive as potential tests that could be used in a clinical setting. Okay, so one of them is this. There was a single paper that was published by Kimada in Japan, in which he reported that there were changes actually in four things. I've only got two of them listed here that are all basically inflammatory markers, and in response to chemical exposure in MCS patients. And so here you were taking a blood sample and measuring nerve growth factor or histamine, and there were also two other inflammatory markers that he looked at. And all of those were increased in response to chemical exposure in the MCS group, but not in a normal group, and also not in another group that had chronic inflammation, but no chemical sensitivity. Okay, so this seems to be specific for MCS. Milkvist and her colleagues in Sweden have published a whole series of papers. I think there are about eight of them now, in which she's been studying the response to capsaicin. Capsaicin is the hot stuff in hot peppers. I don't know, pepperoni. And what she and her colleagues have done is basically spray this into the upper respiratory tract and measure cough responses. In what she finds is that people with MCS typically have cough responses at very low levels of capsaicin that normal people don't react to. So you have to use higher levels of capsaicin to trigger a cough response in people with normal people. And so let me just say, I think this is a local response, okay? So people who don't have sensitivity in their upper respiratory tract will probably not react the way she's been measuring these things. But at least for those people who have local sensitivities there, this should be, I think, an effective specific biomarker test. And let me say one other thing. The pathway of action of capsaicin here in producing cough responses is exactly the same pathway that I talked about before for organic solvents. You get a stimulation of the vanillide receptor, and that in turn increases the NMDA activity, and that in turn produces a cough response. And that whole sequence is required then, so that if you lower the NMDA activity, you can lower the cough response. Okay, so I think that's quite interesting. There are some others, and I guess I probably spent too much time on this already. But there's at least one other type of study involving what's called nasal lavage, where you can actually measure changes in inflammatory markers in the nasal epithelia in response to low-level chemical exposure in people with MCS. And again, there you're talking about a local response in the nasal epithelia. And that one, I think, has some particular nice things, but I don't really have time to talk about it. Okay, let's go on and talk about therapy. All except one of the relevant clinical trials that have been performed on this group of illnesses have been done with either CFS or fibromyalgia patients, okay? There's only one that's been done with MCS. And so what I'm going to do here is to talk about the data that's been accumulated with the CFS and fibromyalgia patients, because obviously it reflects what we think is the general mechanism that's involved here. And there are a number of studies in which antioxidants have been reported to be helpful in the CFS and fibromyalgia group. And those include some flavonoids. They include Eclonia cava extract. This is a brown algal extract. They include, I'm sorry, I've got a spelling error, ascorbate, vitamin C. And this is high dose ascorbate, and I'll talk about that later. So one has evidence that oxidative stress has a causal role in these illnesses. And let me just say, there's also some data, fairly extensive data, with an animal model for chronic fatigue syndrome, where there's also data that quite a number of different antioxidants are helpful in the treatment of that animal model. So we think that oxidative stress has a role. There is quite a bit of data on the use of NMDA antagonists and other agents that indirectly lower NMDA activity that seem to be helpful, particularly with the fibromyalgia group, where there's been a lot of study done on it, but also with the chronic fatigue syndrome group based on clinical observations. And so we think that excessive NMDA activity has an important role. There are agents that improve mitochondrial function that have been shown to be helpful. So we think that mitochondrial dysfunction has an important role here. And so immediately what you're seeing here is different parts of the no-no cycle that are implicated causally in these illnesses simply based on clinical trial data, okay? And that's obviously very important. there is a nitric oxide scavenger, which is hydroxycobalamin. This is a form of vitamin B12, which has been shown to be useful in treatment of the CFS group. And here we're talking about quite high levels of this, which are required in order to get efficient nitric oxide scavenging. Levels that are able to provide a lot of B12 for simple vitamin B12 function are not adequate to produce this response, which is one of the types of evidence, and there are several types of evidence which suggest that this is acting as a nitric oxide scavenger and not acting simply to allay a B12 deficiency. That's obviously important. Fish oil has been shown to be useful with, I believe, both the fibromyalgia and the chronic fatigue syndrome group. And this has important anti-inflammatory properties. And so we think that there's at least some evidence that inflammation has a role. And I mentioned earlier about the inflammatory cytokines, but a lot of the biochemistry of the no-no cycle is inflammatory biochemistry. And so so the notion that anti-inflammatories may be useful is perfectly consistent with the no-no cycle mechanism. There have been clinical trials done on high dose ascorbate and also folic acid, both of which help to restore tetrahydrobiopterin levels. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later. But we think that tetrahydrobiopterin depletion probably has a role based on this information, and in fact there is some other evidence that that's true, which I won't discuss here. So basically, we have evidence simply based on clinical trial data with the CFS and fibromyalgia group that each of the important parts of the no-no cycle seem to have a role causally in producing these illnesses, and therefore, by improving those, you can get measurable clinical responses in these patients. Okay. Now, the only one of these that's ever been tested, as far as I can figure out, with MCS is the high dose ascorbate, and I'll talk about that in a little bit later on. But Heuser and one of his colleagues have published a clinical trial on that with the MCS group. Now, in my book, explaining, quote, unexplained illnesses, I discuss five different protocols that have been developed by different physicians and scientists to treat this group of illnesses that are complex protocols. And these all involve from 14 to 18 different agents or classes of agents, which I predict should act to downregulate different aspects of the NO-NO cycle. And so these are complex protocols, and I would argue that the reason that that people came up with these protocols that involve so many agents that are predicted to downregulate the NO-NO cycle, then I'm arguing that's probably not coincidental, and that is more evidence that the cycle, in fact, is causal here. One of these I had a role in. I worked on with Dr. Gray Zeem, and that's the only one actually that's been tried of those five on chemically sensitive patients. And the description of the responses of those patients is in chapter 15 in my book, so I'm not going to try to discuss that here. Subsequently, I've developed another protocol. This is entirely over-the-counter, based entirely on nutritional supplements. It contains 22 different agents predicted to downregulate different aspects of the NO-NO cycle biochemistry. I don't know that the numbers here are so important, but perhaps the fact that that we are trying to use various parts of the cycle to downregulate different parts of the cycle to try to get better clinical responses. What I'm going to do is to describe to you, and these are simply based on unpublished observations. Most of them have been communicated to me by physicians of their clinical observations. So these are clinical observations and anecdotal reports. And basically you should maintain, obviously, a high level of skepticism about this. But this is sort of my perception of what the response has been to this approach. And let me just say, this protocol is available in the EU and as well as in Canada and the US. What we're seeing roughly is, and let me just say, I'm a PhD, not an MD, okay? I just want to emphasize that, and nothing I say should be viewed as medical advice. About 80 to 85% of the sufferers appear to respond positively to the protocol, and that percentage is roughly similar, at least, with chronic fatigue syndrome, with fibromyalgia, with multiple chemical sensitivity. There doesn't seem to be a big difference among them going from one to the other, which is a little bit surprising because, the perception has been that MCS is the hardest of these to treat, and yet, at least roughly speaking, the MCS patients seem to be responding about equally well to this treatment. Now, obviously, there's a percentage that don't respond positively. I'll talk a little bit about those as well. But generally, one sees improvements that are maintained and by those staying on the protocol. That is, relapses are rare. Okay, so the first thing is that if you have a patient typically who responds well to the protocol, they tend to keep responding well to it. And that is perhaps surprising. Nevertheless, these people are still sensitive to stressors. Okay, so the chemically sensitive people do respond to chemicals with a worsening of symptoms. Many of these people respond to infections and to other stressors, and I may talk a little bit about some of the other stressors that come into this. So they still you know, they still are. They're not asymptomatic, and I'll tell you some of the ways in which we see this. Surprisingly, but the extent of improvement varies a lot among the sufferers. Some of them respond extremely well in a short time period, within weeks, and those include, interestingly, people who've been ill for two decades or longer. In some cases, who respond within weeks to this protocol. And in some cases, it's really surprising that that's true. The person that I've been in contact with who's been ill the longest claims to have been chemically sensitive for over 50 years. And, I mean, basically his whole conscious life. And he's responded surprisingly well to this therapy. Maybe we can talk a little bit about that. One thing that seems to be true is that people who have high levels of mercury in their bodies do not tolerate this protocol. The protocol has seven different pills, basically, that people take. And four of the seven contain alpha-lipoic acid, which is an important antioxidant. But it has a property that it can mobilize mercury in the body. And so we think that probably what's happening is the people who have very high levels of mercury have to undergo mercury detoxification before they can tolerate this protocol. And that's a relatively small group, but obviously for them it's very important. And so that's one group that this does not work well on, at least as long as they have the high levels of mercury. There are some others that basically don't respond either positively or negatively to it, and we're not sure why that is, but I can think of some possibilities that might explain them. Okay. And basically what I've done is to suggest that with these seven different supplement combinations, that people take one for 3 days and see if they tolerate it well, and then take another one for 3 days and so forth. So if a particular supplement is not tolerated, it can be dropped out from the protocol and people can go on with the others. I even ran into one person who said, hey, I can only tolerate one of the seven. She was still getting a positive response to that one, perhaps surprisingly. I don't know why, you know. Generally, you know, as you might expect, the MCS group has more trouble tolerating these than the others. But many of the MCS group tolerate the whole bunch. So that's perhaps surprising. In general, I think in terms of a general approach to therapy, what you need to do, I think, is you need not only to use agents that downregulate the cycle, but you also have to avoid upregulating the cycle. And there are a number of different stressors that will upregulate the cycle. And chemical exposure, in the case of the MCS group, being the most obvious, because we've talked about how that can occur. But I think that the same thing is true, for instance, with exercise in the CFS group. It's true for exposure to allergens, including food allergens, which I think you know food allergy problems are very common with this group. And then there may be some others as well. And so psychological stress may come into this. So I think that in general that, you know, it's important both to avoid stressors that will upregulate the cycle, and to use agents that will downregulate the cycle. Now, you know, one of the things as a scientist that you have to do is you kind of have to be your own worst critic. And it seems to me, if we understand this mechanism well enough, we should be able to start curing people. We're not at that point. And so the question I ask myself is, how can we improve this to the point that we start seeing cures and not just clinical improvements? Okay. And so obviously there are several possible, you know, reasons why we might not be seeing cures. One is maybe we don't understand this well enough. Another one might be, well, the whole no-no cycle is a bunch of hooey and it's not right. Obviously, I'm not going to agree with that one. A third might be that there's some important aspect of this that we're simply not treating well enough. And so I want to consider that third aspect with you. And that is, I think that the real core of the cycle that we talked about before is this relationship between peroxynitrite and tetrahydrobiopterin depletion, okay? Peroxynitrite oxidizes tetrahydrobiopterin, and that in turn gives you this partial uncoupling, which produces more peroxynitrite. So this is probably the real core of the cycle. And because it's the real core, it's particularly important that we treat it well, okay, that we lower this effectively. And if that's true, then okay, so why are we not already treating it well? Well, we have a number of agents in there that are peroxynitrite scavengers, and we also have some agents, and I talked about them briefly before, that will help restore tetrahydrobiopterin pools. But it's not at all clear under the conditions that we're using that any of these work very well. And so one can at least make a case that this couplet, this central couplet of the cycle, is not being treated effectively. Okay? And so the obvious question that one asks then, okay, how can we treat it better? What agent or group of agents can we use to lower the central couplet? And my candidate for that is something that actually may surprise you, and that is high-dose ascorbic acid, high-dose vitamin C, given intravenously. Okay, and so why do I think that that's a good candidate? So we're talking about here high-dose ascorbate, given IV or intravenously. And why do I think that's important? Well, first of all, ascorbate is a peroxynitrite scavenger. That's clear. But it's not clear that it works very well at the normal levels that you have in the blood. In fact, it's pretty clear that it doesn't work well at the normal levels that you get in the blood, even the levels that you typically get from oral supplements, okay? So the argument is that when you use IV ascorbate, you can get levels that are 30 times or even 70 times higher than the normal levels that you normally get. And at those very high levels, one would predict that the IV ascorbate would be vastly more effective as a peroxynitrite scavenger. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is that when peroxynitrite oxidizes tetrahydrobiopterin, so here you got BH4, the oxidation product, the first oxidation product is BH3. Okay, so for those of you who remember your chemistry, that's the one electron oxidation product. And BH3 can then be reduced back to BH4 by ascorbate, by vitamin C. So vitamin C is a reducing agent, and it can then convert BH3 back to BH4. And so the problem here is BH3 is itself unstable, and so it tends to oxidize further. And so that may be a reason why you'd want to have these very high levels of ascorbate to get this reduction, because this stuff doesn't stay around very long. And so you have a short sort of time window to reduce it back. And so it may be useful to have a lot of ascorbate to reduce the BH3 back to BH4. Okay. Now, the third mechanism, which I think may also be important here, is that it's known that high-dose ascorbate in the body generates hydrogen peroxide. And hydrogen peroxide will induce the first enzyme in the pathway for the synthesis of tetrahydrobiopterin. So this is what's known as the de novo pathway for the synthesis of BH4. And that's this enzyme, GTP cyclohydrolase 1. And so by inducing that, what are you going to do? You're going to get more BH4 being produced. And so let me just say that hydrogen peroxide, even though it induces this enzyme, it doesn't oxidize BH4, okay? It's unlike peroxynitrite, which does. Hydrogen peroxide does not. So it doesn't destroy the BH4, but it will induce increased amounts of synthesis. And so that's another activity that could be useful. So I think that's as far as I'm going to go here. And I'm going to. We've got about a half hour for questions. And I hope that if we have questions from people that you want to give in Italian, we might be able to find someone to translate so that I might actually be able to answer them. Sorry, we have a...
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Can find somebody to collaborate with.
Let me just say, I met Dr. Tappan Aja, who's a scientist in New Jersey in the United States, at a meeting last summer, and he's doing some very nice measurements. This is with the CFS group on some of these markers. And he's measured, for instance, in 3-nitrotyrosine, which is thought to be a marker for peroxynitrite. And he's also measured a marker for nitric oxide. Now, let me just say something about this because I think that people have... one of the problems that you have in looking at these is the question of specificity. And the problem basically is that we have so many different chronic inflammatory diseases in human populations that will elevate all of these things, okay? And so generally, to be considered to be abnormal, the levels have to be extreme, okay? They have to be rare, and yet, there are many people with chronic inflammatory diseases So obviously the levels that they have are considered normal, even though they are produced by having chronic inflammatory diseases. So many of the levels that one sees with these groups of illnesses where they've been studied are in fact measured in the normal range. But that doesn't mean that they're not elevated by the mechanism, okay? And so that's a problem when you do these. So when, with tapinadhya, what he sees is that, you know, there's a much higher frequency of people in the abnormal range for these markers, but all of the people with CFS are not in the abnormal range. And so I don't think that's surprising at all, but it's something that basically says that you can't use these as specific tests because they're not specific, and you can't use them as, but you can use them to show that, you know, people have, you know, there's a much higher frequency of abnormal levels. I mean, we measured a marker of nitric oxide, which was elevated in the CFS group, and you know, but again, it was statistically significant difference, but a lot of the people with CFS are still in the normal range.
Mm-hmm. So this cycle you describe is absolutely not specific cycle. And we can do nothing about it. We can, but while prescribing this high doses of ascorbic acid, it's really very dangerous, I think so. Because, for example, it was a very big trend to prescribe ascorbic acid to people with oxidative stress disease, with such pre-oxidative stress disease like thalassemia. And it was a lot of harm to these people.
Yeah, but in thalassemia, you've got a big problem with iron, and that's
so
of course,
if you
yeah.
Prescribe it, if you have clear indications, this person has, mm-hmm. for example, a very low level of transition metals, because if it has, for example, iron, free iron in the blood, and you don't know it because you don't control it, mm-hmm. then with ascorbic acid, it will be like an atomic bomb with explosion of oxidative stress, and he will die. Not support it anymore. So either you can control it before and very strictly, because ascorbic acid has double phase, it is double phased molecule, it is a very strong pro-oxidant and it is sometimes antioxidant. And if you speak about scavenger of peroxynitrite,
yeah.
there are many different molecules which are very more specific for peroxynitrite. For example, selenium, organic selenium compound.
But we're using those already, but the problem is, yeah.
Absolutely
yeah.
No specific for peroxynitrite. And if you don't have any symptoms of peroxynitrite increase in this MCS patient, why should he or she be exposed to such a harm or such a risk of ascorbic acid injection?
Well, let me respond to your point, okay? I think, first of all, you know, there's no question that if you have very high levels of iron, as you do in the patients you were referring to earlier, there's no question that there are problems. What I think is true is that there have been 4 clinical trials done with the CFS group in Japan. All of them have reported favorable responses to high-dose IV ascorbate. There have been no examples of the sorts that you were concerned about. There's been one clinical trial that's been done with the MCS group, and again the responses were quite favorable. I think that you know we need to cure these people. And so far, based on those clinical trials, those data look favorable. Now, my suggestion is that the high dose of ascorbate be used along with all the other agents and only after they've been used for a period of time. and including some of the other antioxidants. So I think that's, but you know, I mean, you know, we can discuss these issues about what the best approach is, but you know, this has been used already with a substantial level of safety. I'm sorry? Yes, it has been published. There are four trials that have been done in Japan, and there's one in the U.S., and those have all been published.
Okay, we'll extend our literature. And then in your protocols, there are many flavonoids inside.
Yes. Well, of course they are, yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I don't think that's really true. I mean, you get clear effects on brain function, for instance, with
culture. Well, no,
I'm not talking about culture. I mean, you know, you can get for instance, with ginkgo extract, there's a fairly extensive literature on improved brain function with some of these diseases. So it obviously has to get in. Alpha lipoic acid gets through the blood-brain barrier. That's one of the arguments that's been used strongly to use it. And obviously ascorbic acid does. I think that it's important, you know, if I've had any effect on this at all, I think it's to show how these various aspects can interact with each other. And while the oxidative stress issue is probably the most important of the cycle, we also have problems with excitotoxicity, with mitochondrial dysfunction, with inflammatory biochemistry. I mean, all those things come into this, and I think also with tetrahydrobiopterin depletion. Those are all things that are very important, and we need to, you know, I think it's a mistake just to look at one aspect of it, and the only thing I'd argue is, and I'm happy to, you know, discuss with you the issue of whether we're using the best flavonoids that you know we should for this, and I'm delighted to get information that we're not doing that as best we can. But most of the people are responding well to the protocol, and most of the people are responding well to the flavonoids. Some of them are not. There are some people that I know of who don't tolerate that part of the protocol, and so they drop it out. So obviously, if we can improve that, I'd be, you know, delighted to get some information from you on that. And any what improvement?
Clinical improvement, or let's say the opinion of the patient or the opinion of the clinician.
Yeah. Look, let me just communicate with you about a particular patient, okay? So you can kind of see where I'm coming from on this, okay? Because it's one thing to talk about these things in generalities. Another thing to look at a specific patient, okay? And I've been in contact with a number of people who have real scientific background and come to their interpretation with, you know, kind of healthy scientific skepticism. And so when I interact with them, I have much more confidence in the accuracy of what they're seeing. And so one person that started this protocol now, I guess about 10 months ago, was a woman whom I met actually at a meeting who lives up in Anchorage, Alaska, and she's given me permission to talk about her case. She had been diagnosed as having MCS from chemical exposure. She used to be a science teacher in the school. And from chemical exposure, apparently. She's been severely ill with MCS for about 20 years. She also has a lot of fatigue and had a lot of cognitive dysfunction. But she did not have post-exertional malaise, which is considered to be the characteristic symptom for CFS. So she doesn't meet the criterion for CFS, although she has a number of the symptoms of CFS. And she also has had post-traumatic stress disorder. So she's been severely ill for a long time, and she has symptoms, at least characteristic of more than one of these illnesses. And she was very skeptical about it because she tried so many things that didn't work for her. She'd been to Bill Ray's clinic, and she tried quite a number of nutritional supplements and so forth, and basically nothing seemed to help her. She goes on the protocol, and she emails me about
2.5 weeks later that she's amazed at the response she's getting. She's not even on the whole protocol yet, and she's already getting an amazing response. Okay, all right. Now, so what's happened? So her cognitive function now is normal. She has essentially no pain problems. Her fatigue is gone. She's still somewhat chemically sensitive. Not as sensitive as she used to be, but she's still somewhat chemically sensitive. So when she goes out into environment where she'll be chemically exposed, she reacts. But instead of being ill for a week or two afterwards, she's ill for about a day, and she's much less ill than she was before. And her friends and her husband both noticed tremendous, obvious improvement just looking at her. Now, I asked, and my question to myself was, why is she responding so well? I would have thought she would have been among the least likely people to respond, because she'd been ill for 20 years, she'd been severely ill. She apparently has symptoms of more than one of these illnesses. On all of those criteria, I would have thought that she would have been among the least likely people to respond. And yet she's responding so well. She, by the way, tolerated the whole protocol. So that's a plus for her, in my judgment. But I think the answer, why she responded so well, is actually very simple. She weighs about 27 kilograms. So she was tiny. And I asked her, well, what did she weigh before she became ill? She had weighed about 40 to 43 kilograms, something like that. So she'd lost about a third of her normal body weight as a function of the illness. And why is that important? Well, because she was getting a much higher dose per unit body weight than most of the other people. So what I inferred from that was that the dosage that I suggested to the other people was inadequate. And in fact, there are quite a number of other people now who've tried higher doses, and they've communicated to me that they get better responses. And so my suggested dosage now has increased as a consequence of that. And it is at least to some extent, based on body weight. Okay? So, I think that, and I can tell you some other stories about people who've responded well. So you're saying we need to do clinical trials. I agree with that. But well, what I'm telling you is about 80 to 85% of the people respond. Okay, so that's it's not just one patient. I'm not saying that that figure 80-85% is written in stone. It may be well that when we get more information that will change. But most people seem to respond well to it. You had a question. We're trying to get a clinical trial going in France right now. I'm working with a MCS support group there. They're very much interested in doing that. Whether we'll actually be able to do it or not is another issue. I don't know yet whether we'll be able to do it.
So for the moment, the clinical trials are taking place in the United States, not...
No, there are no clinical trials currently occurring with this protocol. Let me just say, with regard to the other protocols that I talked about, the five that I discussed in my book, two of them have been tested in clinical trials. One is Jacob Teitelbaum's protocol. Jacob Teitelbaum's protocol. That's a very complex one, and because he basically uses a different protocol for each patient, depending on what the test results are, and so it's a complex approach. But they have done a placebo-controlled trial, actually two of them, one with the CFS group and one with the fibromyalgia group, and they've gotten positive results with both. The other one is a protocol that was developed by Garth Nicholson, which is mainly designed to improve mitochondrial function. And he also has reported statistically significant improvements with that protocol. No, that's in the U.S. Both of those, both Teitelbaum's and Nicholson's were in the U.S., yeah. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't mean simply ascorbic acid. Maybe you mean magnesium ascorbate or potassium ascorbate.
Well, I don't know. I mean, as a chemist, the ascorbate is just the anion. So, yeah, you're asking what the cation would be with it. I'd have to look up the individual trials that have been done to see what they use for that. I don't know. But yeah, you generally don't want to use a highly acid pH for these infusions.
Is it possible to measure the pH 1 to 1.5, like ascorbic acid has pH 1.5? How can you inject it? Of course, it's used with some kind of metals, with calcium or magnesium or something. It should be neutralized. Otherwise, it's impossible. You will just make the burn up.
But the question was slightly different because I know that if you prepare the ascorbic acid with magnesium or potassium, you can obtain a real molecule of ascorbate for some hour at low time. The question, I can imagine that if you use faster with this product, you have different effects than using ascorbate after 2 hours from the preparation. This was the question, because the action of ascorbate and simply using a product mixed with the acid, because it's very different. Yes. This was just the question. And the second question about polymorphism.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
About the polymorphism of the cytochromes.
Yeah, the cytochrome. Yes. Cytochrome P450s, is it? Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Have you seen some difference between the control population and MCS population? Do you have some evidence of the difference?
No. I mean, you know, there is some of the genetic evidence. One of the genes that predisposed towards increased susceptibility was the P450 gene. But no, in fact, it's difficult to look at that. I mean, the nitric oxide effect on cytochrome P450 is an inhibition. It's not an inactivation. So, you know, of course, you can't take brain tissue anyway out and measure it. But, you know, if you could take tissue out, say, in peripheral tissue and measure cytochrome P450, the prediction is it would be normal. Because at that point, the nitric oxide would dissociate and you wouldn't see any inhibition. So, in fact, I believe there was a study done of that sort where they showed it was normal, but I don't know that that means anything. So it's a difficult thing to test because you're looking at nitric oxide as an inhibitor of cytochrome P450. And of course, when you know, if you isolate tissues, that inhibition will be gone because nitric oxide is unstable. So, yeah.
Like PT4, PT4, GST, different high enzymes of this. And then my question, because
Well, but those, that heterogeneity in terms of sensitivity may simply be due to the polymorphisms that we've already talked about.
We tried to find out the molecular basis for this. We tried just to investigate whether it is at genic level or it is at epigenic level. Even
well, that, that's... Look, this is not entirely either genetic or epigenetic. The point is that, that these are initiated by chemical exposure, and the point is that these people respond to treatments that will not change the genetics and probably won't change the epigenetics either, although I'm not convinced that that there's any real epigenetic role here at all. I could be wrong about that. I think... you know, I mean, the point is that that we do have responses to these clinical treatments, and so you know, there's no point in tearing our hair about the genetics is simply understood in terms of susceptibility, and I think that's. Let me just say, there's another gene that's been implicated, which is. Which influences the NMDA receptor activity indirectly.
Suspected, not
no, it's it.
Nobody has any evidence for this.
What do you mean? There's no evidence for it.
No evidence.
Well, it's been published. You're saying what are you saying? There's no the published evidence is wrong or what? What are you saying? I'm sorry.
Is it,
I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
If it is genetic a trait, then we have to be very to change our genetics or our directions in the treatment.
Yeah, but these things are not either genetic or non-genetic. The genetic role is to increase susceptibility. And that doesn't mean that the disease is inherently different when it occurs. It may mean that it's more difficult to treat if there's a susceptibility problem. I have to say, in the rare case, in fact, I only have one case where there's pretty good evidence for a major genetic susceptibility role with some of the patients who've gone on our protocol, and they seem to respond quite well to it, despite the fact that they're probably carrying a susceptibility gene. So, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure that the genetics necessarily implies that that the approach to treatment is necessarily going to be different.
I think it's very difficult to find a very common track because they are all multifactorial pathologies. When we have 10 patients with the same diagnosis, MCS,
mm-hmm.
one patient can have an overload from toxic stuff, virus, psychological stress, and so on. The second one can have the same, but it's a different chemical stuff. It's a different virus and so on. Perhaps it's impossible to go straight to one only factor as like etiology. Yeah. This is very important to have this basic biochemical grounds because this is at least and finally a common basis we have it till now. And on this common basis then when we have to go straight to each patient, is each different world, each patient is different. We have
to have the characteristic of this patient, not only clinical characteristics.
This is the characteristic, the biochemical.
Yes, and then
this is
I'm speaking about.
Yes.
That we have to check every patient.
Yes.
For this characteristic, because the professor just presented us his hypothesis from biology, from the general biology. Not for the patient, but my question was whether patients were controlled for these parameters.
It's very difficult because the one patient can deal only with psychotherapy. I make no sense.
Yeah.
One patient can only with another significant therapy with care and so on. Because each patient on this common basis, and it's very important, then goes to.
I'm afraid I have to leave. because we have to go to the airport, and I'm not sure how I get a taxi here. Is anybody? Oh. Can someone call for a taxi? We calculated before we had to leave now, so I need to go. Yeah. I'd be happy I'm going to be about 2 weeks traveling before I get home, but I'd be happy to interact with you over email, and we can discuss things at that point. But
so. Okay. Mm-hmm. What's that?
I don't, they're not mine, so I don't know. But yeah, I guess that's probably what Francesca wanted.
Yeah.
I think.
It's your article, right?
Huh?
It's your article.
Yeah, but she translated. I don't know. I gave her permission to do to use it however she wanted. So I don't know what. Okay. Okay.
Very nice talk.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh,
just
yes.
To make sure if there were any okay. doctors or anybody.
Yes, it's called it. Entitled it. It's explaining quote unexplained illnesses.
Sorry, because I came later.
Yeah.
The title is
explaining quote. So quote, you know, yeah, unexplained illnesses, unquote.
And this I can find on the internet.
You could order it from Amazon or Barnes and Noble.
Amazon.
They have the paperback is much cheaper than the hardbound. Sometimes when you go on the Amazon site, it puts the hardbound one up first, and then, you know, it's a lot more money. But
I am Francesco Pesce. I'm a urologist here in
yes.
Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Neuro-urologist.
Yeah.
I treat a lot of patients with IC, interstitial cystitis,
chronic
pain. I also see patients with fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, and I'm following up some MCS patients because they seem to have also lower urinary tract symptoms for some reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
This is your experience?
I'm a PhD, so I don't treat patients, but I know of some that have urinary tract problems, and so I mean I think what you see with this whole group is that they have many chronic inflammatory problems.
IBS, for example.
Yeah. Yes. Uh huh. And some, perhaps many of those are may also be known as cycle diseases of their own, and located in different in different things. But and if that's true, then they should all respond to the therapy. But that's what we don't know yet whether they will or not. So
I was interested because you mentioned the alpha lipoic acid because I am using sometimes for. Neuropathic inflammation, compression of the pudendal nerve, etc. And I also noticed that, I read something about the possibility of mobilizing
mercury. Yeah.
this is established?
I don't know that literature, but my understanding is that it is. That's my understanding. And so basically, it's the reduced form that mobilizes the mercury. Mm. So the alpha lipoic acid that you use, of course, when it gets transported into the cell, it rapidly gets reduced to dihydrolipoic, and it's that.
So I try to avoid impatient with some dental. I don't know the word.
With mercury fillings.
Yes.
I'm not sure that it's a problem with most of them.
No.
My impression is that it's only a problem with people who have very high levels of mercury, and they
in the blood or the tissues.
In the tissues, and often I think my understanding. Again, I'm not an expert on this.
They've called the taxi
microphone before you go.
Okay, good.